It is time now to begin the reading of the Boston Globe. On the Talking Information Center, it is Thursday, the 20th of August, 2026. And with today's Boston Globe, we say hello to Mary and Kelly.
Thank you, John, and welcome all listeners. And today, Kelly's going to start with our first article. Kelly.
Thank you, Mary. The first article today is Major Advance in Cancer Treatment. Dose from Moderna acts like vaccine to curb melanoma recurrence. It's written by Maren Wolf and Jonathan Saltzman. Moderna, the Cambridge biotech that helped contain the pandemic, on Wednesday reported the first successful results of a personalized messenger RNA vaccine in a late-stage trial to treat melanoma, which experts say could foreshadow its use against other cancers. Each dose of the vaccine was tailor-made to the genetic sequence of a patient's cancer and paired with drug maker Merck's blockbuster immunotherapy, Keytruda, after the cancerous lesion was surgically removed. Melanoma is the deadliest form of skin cancer. Unlike conventional vaccines, which ward off infectious diseases, the trial tested a therapeutic vaccine called Intismerin that harnesses the body's immune system to prevent a recurrence or spreading of cancerous lesions. Moderna and its business partner, Merck, said the dual treatment, compared to Keytruda alone, extended how long patients live without the cancer returning, as well as how long they live without new cancerous lesions appearing in other parts of the body. The companies have yet to release detailed data from the randomized phase 3 clinical trial. But if the results hold up, they could herald broader use of the technology, known as individualized neoantigen therapy. Moderna's stock price nearly tripled Wednesday on the news. From a science perspective, this has been one of the holy grails, Moderna's chief development officer, David Berman, said. I have gotten lots of texts from melanoma experts around the world, just thrilled that this has finally worked. Because if it works here, it's bound to work in other tumors as well. Robert Langer, a co-founder of Moderna and renowned biomedical engineering professor at MIT, called the results a potential paradigm shift for cancer treatment. Langer, who developed the liquid nanoparticles that deliver the mRNA into the body, noted Merck and Moderna are studying the use of personalized vaccines in several trials across other tumors, including non-small cell lung cancer, bladder cancer, and renal cell carcinoma. So far, the only proof is with melanoma, but it's a stunning example of what can be done, Langer said. I don't see any reason why it wouldn't work with other types of cancer. In an earlier mid-stage trial, the drug makers reported in June that giving patients both the individualized mRNA vaccine and Keytruda decreased the risk of recurrence of the disease and new lesions appearing elsewhere in the body, both by 49%, compared to Keytruda alone after patients had been followed for 5 years, according to STAT, the Globe's sister publication. The results were welcome news for Moderna. The homegrown 16-year-old company has struggled in recent years to reinvent itself following its breakout success during the pandemic and subsequent fall from favor when noted vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. took the helm of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. In 2025, the Trump administration canceled a $766 million contract with the firm to develop an mRNA vaccine against bird flu and other viruses that could cause future pandemics. Earlier this month, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved Moderna's mRNA flu vaccine for older adults after a will-they-won't-they battle with the federal agency that initially refused to review the shot, citing issues with Moderna's data collection. Outside experts said Moderna's vicissitudes reflected the shifting political headwinds that vaccine makers will almost certainly continue to face. Indeed, Moderna no longer uses the term vaccine to describe its melanoma treatment, as the word has become radioactive in today's political climate. The company instead calls it a therapy. Kennedy has criticized the mRNA platform, but Langer said a rapidly growing body of evidence shows it is safe and has many applications. Whether you look at Galileo or Copernicus, in the end, science wins, Langer said. Business analysts and investors seem to agree. Moderna's share price closed at more than $174, up from $63 at market close Tuesday. Based on comments made by Moderna's top executives, the company should win approval of the melanoma vaccine from the FDA and start marketing it next year, said Tyler Van Buren, an analyst with TD Cowen. Van Buren nonetheless said it was premature to predict Moderna's experimental personalized mRNA vaccines will work against other cancers. Trials of those vaccines need to conclude first, he said. The idea of a personalized cancer vaccine is not new. Years ago, researchers recognized that advances in genomics sequencing could make it easier to identify and target cancerous tumors, said Dr. Catherine Wu, chief of transplant and cellular therapies at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Cancer is often tricky to distinguish in the body because the mutated cells can resemble normal cells. In other words, they have little cloaks of invisibility, Wu said. Now, scientists have better ways to recognize the tiny differences on the surface of cancer cells, making it possible to train the body's immune system via a vaccine to attack them. What's particularly encouraging about the new results is the scope of the trial, which included more than 1,000 patients and the use of customized vaccines. Phase 3 trials, the last step before a company can request FDA approval, are usually the signal of whether a field continues or dies, Wu said. Creating individualized vaccines can be difficult and expensive, said Wu, who was not involved in Moderna's trials. But as the shots become more widely available, that process should get faster. I'm fully confident that our industry partners will solve that problem, Wu said. Dr. Ryan Sullivan, director of cutaneous medical oncology at Mass General Brigham Cancer Institute, said the success of this form of cancer vaccination could usher in a new pillar of treatment for patients. Sullivan enrolled patients in the phase 2 and phase 3 trials of the Moderna therapy and helped shape the design of the trial. I have excitement for the field, excitement for our patients, Sullivan said. Obviously, there's a lot of steps that have to be taken and fulfilled before it becomes a tangible thing we can offer patients. But it's an announcement that just makes me happy that we're seeing positive results on a trial. Before Wednesday, Moderna's stock had lost more than 80% of its value from its peak early in the pandemic. Moderna's vaccine to fend off COVID made billionaires out of several of the biotech's founders and top executives. The company made layoffs last year and now has 2,600 employees in Massachusetts, a spokesperson said. Previously, it had 4,434 employees, according to a 2025 industry snapshot by the trade group MassBio. Manufacturing of the melanoma vaccines takes place at Moderna's facility in Marlborough. Miles Minter, a healthcare research analyst at the investment bank William Blair, said it's hard to overstate how big a deal the late-stage results of the melanoma trial is to Moderna. The company has 4 FDA-approved products, but they're all vaccines to ward off infectious diseases, COVID, RSV, and seasonal flu. Minter, who in March told the Globe that Moderna needed to diversify away from vaccines for infectious diseases, said the new results from the trial show the company is well positioned to do that. There is now a line of sight to a non-infectious disease growth trajectory for Moderna, he said. That did not exist yesterday. Over to you, Mary.
Thank you, Kelly. SJC from the front page. SJC clears the way for work at White Stadium. Ruling rejects opponent's lawsuit, giving Mayor Wu a win, by Nikki Griswold of the Globe staff. After more than 2 years of rising costs and legal pushback, Mayor Michelle Wu's $325 million plan to renovate White Stadium in Franklin Park cleared one of its final hurdles yesterday, allowing the city and professional women's soccer teams to press ahead with one of Mayor Wu's administration's most ambitious and polarizing projects. The Supreme Judicial Court Wednesday rejected a lawsuit trying to halt the project, ruling the overhaul does not violate an arcane state law that protects public park land and handing Mayor Wu a major legal and political victory. The stadium's renovation has drawn intense scrutiny and criticism both over the scale of the project and the escalating price tag, and at the same time was featured prominently on the campaign trail during her successful re-election bid a year ago. The ruling officially also puts an end to the years-long lawsuit to stop controversial projects brought on by the environmental nonprofit, the Emerald Necklace Conservancy, and a coalition of residents who live in the neighborhood surrounding Franklin Park. And we turn our page. Work on the site, which has been underway since early 2025, is now officially free to continue. The renovated stadium will serve as a new hub for Boston School Athletics and home stadium for the National Women's Soccer League team, Boston Legacy FC. In its ruling Wednesday, the SJC determined that state lawmakers more than 75 years ago designated the stadium site as a school building and yard, not a parkland, and therefore the city's plan to overhaul White Stadium with a private company does not violate state park protection. At an unrelated press conference yesterday, Mayor Wu said she was thrilled with the court's decision and that this landmark investment in our future can move forward without further delay. Boston should be a place where we can and will do big things that matter for our community, and that we can take a big swing when things get done. Mayor Wu said that will open up a world of possibilities for generations to come. Boston Legacy FC, the soccer team, also celebrated the ruling, calling it a tremendous victory for Boston, public school students, and the Franklin Park community, and the future of professional women's soccer in Boston. The court's decision clears the way for completing the White Stadium renovation and delivering a world-class facility that will serve our community for generations, Jennifer Epstein, the team's controlling owner, said. Karen Mauney Brodeck, president of the Emerald Necklace Conservancy, said the group was disappointed by the court's decision and reiterated its call for the city to pursue a smaller, fully public renovated White Stadium. Pamela Jones, a Mattapan resident who signed on as the plaintiff in the lawsuit, lamented the ruling will allow for a stadium she said some residents do not want. The communities around Franklin Park wanted a renovated White Stadium that doesn't displace the Boston Public Schools football program, pave over access of public parkland and subject neighborhoods to traffic and other negative impacts of an oversized professional sports complex. The SJC had a 130-day guideline to issue its decision, but last week ordered a waiver on the 4-plus-month span, giving itself more time to weigh in on its decision in White Stadium's lawsuit. Amid that delay, neither team nor the city had committed to the stadium being ready for some or all of the 2027 season, which begins in February and runs into November. Mayor Wu on Wednesday did not offer an update target completion date, but said the project is on budget and hitting its planned construction milestones. Mayor Wu and other supporters have pitched the stadium as a once-in-a-generation opportunity to overhaul a dilapidated facility and give the city residents and Boston Public School students access to professional-grade sports facility without taxpayers shouldering the entirety of the redevelopment cost. The project's opponents argued that the involvement of the Boston Legacy FC for profit sports team would illegally allow private company to make money off public parkland and improperly limit the public access to the Boston Public Schools facility. Critics have said that the city should pursue a less expensive and less ambitious renovation and fund it with city dollars and donations to keep the facility solely for public use. The Emerald Necklace Conservancy and a coalition of residents first sued to stop the project in February 2024. The plaintiffs argued that the public-private plan to renovate the stadium violates a state constitutional amendment called Article 97, which protects public parkland and requires approval from 2/3 of the state legislature to sell or make changes to the park use. The city argued that the stadium will continue to be owned by the city and primarily used by the Boston Public School students and Boston residents, with Boston Legacy FC using the stadium for a maximum of 20 home games and 20 practices each year. A Supreme Court judge ultimately ruled that the city's favor in April last year, but the plaintiffs appealed the decision. In its ruling Wednesday, the Supreme Judicial Court acknowledged that the stadium land was taken by eminent domain for use as a public park in 1883. But the court noted that state lawmakers passed legislation in 1947 and in 1950 that transferred the ownership of that parcel to a public charitable trust known as the George Robert White Fund, allowing the city to build White Stadium. The legislation effectively removed the stadium parcel from its previous designation as parkland and made it the school department's facility to be maintained by the school committee. Justice Gabriel R. Wohan wrote for the court and allowed the transferred land to be used for any purpose in line with the provisions of the trust, including its uses inconsistent with park status. Therefore, the stadium land is not subject to Article 97 protections, the court ruled. One supporter of the renovation, Seth Davis, who lives in Jamaica Plain across the street from Franklin Park with his wife and three daughters, said his family has been following the project for years and feared that the lawsuit would slow it down or kill it. The court's ruling is a relief, he said. I'm hopeful that the renovated stadium will be a much more active place. Rising price tag for the work has also triggered intense criticism and scrutiny. Boston Unity Soccer Partners first proposed to make more than $30 million in renovations to the more than 74-year-old stadium in July of 2023. But earlier in 2024, both the soccer team and the city of Boston had bookmarked $50 million for their portion of the project, according to legal documents. The city's share of the project then now rose to $91 million by the end of 2024. Despite pledging to share an updated cost estimate before the end of 2025, Mayor Wu, who won the re-election last fall, did not provide a new figure until February, when she announced that the overhaul would cost $325 million. Legacy FC is expected to pay about $190 million of that total, while the city will contribute $135 million. Mayor Wu attributed those cost increases to inflation, tariffs, and the rising cost of materials and labor. She also said the higher price tag was driven by expensive design changes to the project based on feedback from the neighbors, Boston residents, Boston Public School families, and other members of the parks community. The team is also expected to pay more than $62 million over the coming year in rent to the city and for the maintenance of the stadium and improvements to Franklin Park and other community benefits. Kelly?
Thank you, Mary. The next article is titled, Tactic Appears to Skirt PAC Rule. Red Boxes on Candidate Sites Offer Strategies. And it's written by Kelly Garrity. Flagging in polling and with his political future on the line, Representative Seth Moulton is taking any shot he can to unseat Senator Ed Markey in their Democratic Senate primary. So late last week, his campaign drew up an 11th-hour play. The move, laid out in a discreetly placed section of Moulton's campaign website, called for airing an ad on TV and digital platforms during Thursday's final primary debate between the two candidates, painting the Salem Democrat as one of Massachusetts' rising progressive stars and warning of the wider consequences if the 80-year-old Markey's health should falter, should he win another six-year term. But it's not Moulton's campaign that would run the ad or foot the bill for it. Rather, that job would fall to a super PAC backing his bid, which, legally speaking, Moulton isn't supposed to do game planning with. But Moulton and other Massachusetts candidates are sidestepping that pesky rule this year thanks to a tactic known as red boxing, the approach in which candidates publicly post messaging and suggestions for outside groups to follow, allows them to flout rules preventing them from coordinating with super PACs, which, unlike the campaigns themselves, can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money. In some cases, campaigns provide specific guidance in those red-framed boxes, which voters to target, what message to deliver, where to place an ad, and when to begin spending. They often include links to digital folders featuring photos and video clips, providing a super PAC with the raw materials it might need to cobble together, say, a 30-second digital ad. But because it's on a public, albeit slightly difficult to find, part of the candidate's campaign website, technically anyone can see it, and then drag and drop the language and materials into an ad or mailer on the candidate's behalf. And copy and paste they have, collectively putting millions of dollars behind their preferred candidates, sometimes with the exact messaging the candidates prefer. On State Representative Tram Nguyen's website, for example, the 6th congressional district candidate stresses in a media section of her campaign website that she came to the United States with her parents as a 5-year-old immigrant fleeing an authoritarian regime with $100. Why I couldn't say that word. In recent days, Save America Fund, a Rhode Island-based super PAC that so far has reported shelling out almost $88,000 on behalf of Nguyen, began filling voters' mailboxes with slick mailers noting that Nguyen came to America with $100 and arrived at 5 years old, fleeing an authoritarian regime with her parents. Another that reached 6th District residents this week attributed a similar quote directly to the candidate. "I know what authoritarianism takes away." A spokesperson for the PAC didn't respond to a request for comment. Candidates have for years used the maneuver, named for the literal red boxes most campaigns use to highlight information they hope outside groups will notice. "It emerged as a way for candidates to work around the federal rules," said Saurav Ghosh, the director of the Federal Campaign Finance Reform Program at Campaign Legal Center. But the practice has exploded in Massachusetts this year, with Moulton and candidates in at least 3 congressional primaries embracing some form of it as outside money pours into their races. There aren't any federal laws explicitly barring the practice, though watchdog groups such as Ghosh's argue it undermines the spirit of the rules. As much as red boxing seems like a cute practice where candidates wink and nod and provide signals to super PACs, what's really at stake is the electoral voice of everyday Americans, Ghosh said. Dan Coe, one of the 6 Democrats running in the 6th District, has littered his own so-called red box with family photos and specific messaging, touting his time working for former President Joe Biden and former Boston Mayor Martin J. Walsh, and on the Andover Select Board. From working in the Biden White House to leading Mayor Marty Walsh's City Hall and serving on the Andover Select Board, Coe is the, quote, "fighter with the experience we need now," quote, read one mailer sent by new leadership PAC, a super PAC backing him. Patrick Roth, the Jamaica Plain attorney challenging Representative Stephen Lynch in the 8th Congressional District, is the only candidate in this race refusing corporate donations, read the since updated section on Roth's website. Almost word for word, the blurb appeared on a multi-page mailer that "Leaders We Deserve," the progressive group founded by gun control activist David Hogg, sent out on his behalf earlier this month. The page on Roth's campaign website, updated Monday, now calls for the promotion of a video of Lynch tangling with a constituent, quote, "if budget allows," end quote. Roth's and Coe's campaigns didn't respond to requests for comment for the story. Moulton's and Nguyen's campaigns didn't directly address the public coordination between their operations and the PACs backing them. Taylor Hebel, a spokesperson for Moulton, said in a statement the campaign can't control what our supporters do. Matt McKenna, a spokesperson for Advance Progress, the super PAC that's backed Moulton's Senate bid, declined to comment. Amanda Munger, a spokesperson for Nguyen, said her candidate isn't a self-funded candidate or one funded by the corporate elite. That the practice has been common among Democrats creates an awkward stance for a party whose members also tend to spend a fair amount of time arguing that campaign finance laws need tightening. This cycle, too, has also seen a flood of outside spending. Advanced Progress has so far spent close to $2.9 million, topping the more than the $1.6 million spent by a super PAC called Commonwealth Together PAC, which is backing Markey. Markey's campaign doesn't appear to have its own red box. In the 6th District, the state's only open congressional seat this year, the new leadership PAC has spent more than $870,000 to boost Co. Leaders We Deserve has put more than $250,000 behind Roth's bid to unseat Lynch. The red boxing practice has even seeped into contests where the incumbents already have a substantial fundraising advantage. Representative Jake Auchincloss's campaign tucked a section at the bottom of its Jake in the Media webpage, directing an outside group to target likely Democratic primary voters who participated in at least one of the last three primaries. Those voters, Auchincloss's blurb says, need to see in their mailboxes and across various platforms that Auchincloss is a young parent who understands the struggles working families face. Auchincloss, meanwhile, had $7.4 million in his account at the end of June, while his primary challenger, Jason Polos, an AI researcher from Sherborne, reported having about $20,000. Lo and behold, Protect Progress, a cryptocurrency-focused super PAC, reported last week it had spent about $47,000 on mailers supporting Auchincloss. The message, Auchincloss is, quote, a father with a young family, end quote, who, quote, understands the struggles that so many face, end quote. Over to you, Mary.
Thank you, Kelly. From the world section of the Globe today, United Arab Emirates halts trade with Iran as President Trump pushes to isolate Tehran. U.S. pressures Iran economy as war continues. This article is by Ismail Nair and Vivian Nirim of the New York Times. Dubai, United Arab Emirates, said it is halting all trade and financial transactions with Iran, adding further economic pressure on the Islamic Republic as President Trump's administration pushes to isolate it. The decision announced soon after the Emirati government accused Iran of launching missiles toward its territory while it made in-light regional escalations that undermine the regional international peace and security. Alfra Al-Hamali of the spokesperson for the Emirati Foreign Ministry said in a statement late Tuesday. She also added that the United Arab Emirates was firmly committed to safeguarding the integrity of the international financial system. The United Arab Emirates, located just 50 miles from Iran across the Persian Gulf, has nurtured close economic and cultural ties with the Islamic Republic for decades, despite financial tensions between two countries. The Iranian-Emirati trade was worth roughly $28 billion in 2024, when the United Arab Emirates was Iran's largest source of imports, ferrying electronics, precious metals, and other goods to Islamic Republic, according to the World Trade Organization data. Analysts say that the trade through Dubai and the United Arab Emirates is the largest Dubai is the largest city, has long been a key to Iranian efforts to evade sanctions, elicit complaints, and pressure from the United States authorities in the past. The Emirati officials say that they crack down on any sanctions violations when they find them. President Trump's administration has been keen to increase economic pressure on Iran while trying to find a resolution to the nearly six-month war, which has left Iran with a significant control over shipping in the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow waterway that is key transit route for oil and gas. Last week, Scott Bessent, United States Secretary of the Treasury, threatened to apply measures to have never been seen in the history of economic isolation of a country. It is unclear if the United States plans a role in the United Arab Emirates decision. The announcement came hours after a call from President Trump to the Emirati leader Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan In a separate call on Tuesday, Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Sheikh Tahuni bin Zayed and the Emirati National Security Advisor discussed efforts to hold Iran accountable for the ongoing attacks, according to the State Department spokesperson Tommy Pigott. The Emirati Foreign Ministry did not respond to requests for comments about the motivation and timing of the decision. It is also unclear how seriously and swiftly the Emirati government will move to enforce a suspension of economic ties. Esfandra Bademagandjilidi, as chief executive of the Bourse and Bazaar Foundation, a London-based think tank focused on Iran's economy, expressed skepticism, saying that the announcement does not necessarily indicate a change in policy. Instead, it could be read as a moment of public diplomacy directed at the United States, intended to signal that the United Arab Emirates is continuing to keep Iran at arm's length. In reality, Iran and the United Arab Emirates continue to be economically interdependent, and the Emirati government made a statement that did not make it clear whether the decision to halt trade was made or specify what prompted it. But last week, the United Arab Emirates accused Iran of attacking the Emirati oil tanker traveling through the Strait of Hormuz. On Wednesday, the Emirati Defense Ministry issued warnings of incoming missile attacks, later saying that the two ballistic missiles launched from Iran had targeted maritime navigation and the one had fallen in Emirati waters. Iran denied carrying out those attacks and has neither denied nor claimed responsibility for the recent tanker strikes. Before the United States and Israel attacked Iran in February, setting off a regional conflagration, the Emirati officials had been pursuing a strategy of diplomacy and economic engagement with Iran, their much larger neighbor, hoping that they would insulate the United Arab Emirates from any conflict. The war shadowed that the assumption and the ties between the United Arab Emirates and Iran rapidly soured as the United Arab Emirates, which hosts a major U.S. military base, bore the initial brunt of Iran's retaliation, reporting more than 2,700 ballistic missiles and drone attacks from Iran. Kelly?
Thank you, Mary. And so now we're going to move to the metro section here on page B3. We have some happy news. Sweet celebration. Bova's marks 100th anniversary. And it's written by Jane Miller. Tucked into the corner of Salem and Prince Streets in Boston's North End, the small but popular Bova's Bakery celebrated 100 years in business this week. "You have to marry this place in order to be successful," said owner Ralph Bova, 69. Famous for being open 24 hours in a 10-minute walk from TD Garden, the bakery has been a community staple. Out of the three, Mike's Pastry, Bova's Bakery, and Modern Pastry, customer Grace Lozier, 18, said of the North End bakeries, "Bova's is the best." In Lozier's opinion, Bova's has the most authentic cannoli. "The other spots are more touristy, and this one's more of a hole in the wall," she said. The Bova's Bakery story begins in 1926 at a small shop across the street from its current address. Ralph Bova said his grandfather, Antonio Bova, who immigrated from Calabria, Italy, started making and delivering bread. They used to deliver it door to door and told the customers, "If you like my bread, I'm going to be opening up at 79 Prince Street," said Bova. And before you know it, people would come because they enjoyed it. By 1932, the family had to move across the street to accommodate the uptake in business, he said. "As businesses started growing, we moved over here and bought this property for like $2,000 at the time," said Bova. "The whole family got involved," he said. Bova's father and his two uncles divided up management so that each brother would rotate being in charge of bakery operations. "They came up with a system because they were at each other's throats," Bova said with a laugh. Bova began working his own shifts at the bakery at the ripe age of 8. He would come downstairs from their apartment, located directly on top of the North End shop, and get to sweeping. I used to stand on a milk case and they would teach me how to make a braid, said Bova, who was then too short to reach the countertops. In the 1970s, Bova said that the bakery began selling pastries in its famed cannoli, attracting more customers. By the time Bova was 16, his father made him an offer to take over the bakery with his brother, Anthony. We started getting busier and busier, Bova said. It took a lot of hard work. During the pandemic, the bakery thrived with large shipment requests from local places, including Massachusetts General Hospital, and from people across the country who had seen it online. My business during COVID tripled, said Bova. We got more busy and pretty much famous over the last few years, said Ralph's niece, Lauren Bova Cole, 40, who works behind the counter. That's when we started social media and it brought a lot of people in. One of the few times the bakery broke its 24-hour open streak was for Matt Damon and Casey Affleck's The Instigators, which filmed there in March 2023. In honor of the 100-year anniversary, Bova's hosted a celebration with free mini cannoli on Tuesday. It was awesome, Bova said. They really enjoyed it, and Mayor Wu was filling them up. Mayor Michelle Wu, who bestowed the bakery with a citation for being open 100 years, assisted in the cannoli distribution, along with several city councilors, Bova said. Bova's bakery has been a treasured family business in the North End, said North End City Councilor Gabriela Coletta Zapata in a statement to the Globe. I'm grateful for the memories they've helped create and wish Bova's continued success as a cherished community staple for years to come. They gave out several thousand mini cannoli, said Bova. It felt great. Honestly, it really did, said Bova Cole, 40. It might have aggravated a few neighbors, she added with a laugh. The line wrapped all the way around the block from Salem to Thatcher Street. The key to a good business, Ralph Bova says, is a good product. No matter what, I keep my product fresh, said Bova. I got people that have been with me for over 30 years, the same people making the stuff. In the back of Bova's, workers slather icing onto cakes or delicately fill the famous Florentine cannoli with dollops of cream. By noon on Wednesday, Bova's was buzzing with lunchtime customers. It's a great Boston landmark that everyone should visit, said Thomas Wessner. Wessner, a professor at Boston College, brought a group of incoming students to Bova's on Wednesday so they could get to know the place. Everything here is excellent, Wenner said. The culture, the people, the reputation, the quality of the food. Several of his students had already tried Bova's and were eager to get their favorite items. The meatball and cheese rice ball, the Rocky Road brownie, and the cannoli are really good, said student Jeff Larson, 18, from North Attleboro. I come Christmas Eve to get bread and pastries, said student Adrian Lund, 19, of Weston. 100 years is a long time, but the Bovas have no intention of leaving anytime soon. I'm going to leave it to my kids, Bova said with a smile, as long as they can. Over
to
you.
Thank you, Kelly. Makes me want to go there.
I know. I'm so hungry now.
I'll be doing it. Also from the metro section is Mayor Wu names new executive director for election department. Decision comes after a turbulent period for office by Audrey Tomlin of the Globe correspondent. Mayor Michelle Wu announced Kerry Jordan, previously the city's chief of staff for the development of the innovation and technology, will serve as the executive director for the city's election department. The announcement Wednesday comes less than 2 weeks ahead of the state's primary election and the numerous struggles the city's election department has had. It was placed under the state receivership last year by Massachusetts Secretary of State William F. Galvin. As we approach the primaries, we're working to ensure that Boston's voter can participate confidently, sanely, and freely in our democracy, Mayor Wu said at the press conference outside Boston City Hall. Kerry Jordan is the son of the of Dorchester, a Boston Public Schools alum, and has a dedicated public servant who knows the right tech tools can help close gaps between the city and our communities. Kerry Jordan will oversee the operations and personnel within the election department, according to a spokesperson for the mayor. He will assume the role of the week after the primary election. Until then, City Registrar Paul Chong, who is serving as an acting head of the department, will continue leading the day-to-day operations. Secretary Galvin's office was not consulted on Kerry Jordan's appointment because his hiring was a personnel decision regarding the City Hall staffing, according to Deborah O'Malley, a spokesperson for Secretary Galvin. We're in daily contact. We've been monitoring their progress in mailing out ballots as well as overseeing ballot distribution plans. Our receiver will be at City Hall throughout the day as needed, as well as during the voting to keep an eye on the process and report back. City has hired more than 1,860 poll workers, including more than 400 workers who speak multiple languages, scheduled more than 100 poll workers training sessions, and expanded the City's call staffing center. Mayor Wu said all that at a press conference. Early last year, Secretary Galvin's office placed the election department under state receivership after finding several unacceptable issues in the administering of the 2024 presidential election. Then in February, the city's longtime election commissioner, Anita Tavares, quietly and voluntarily left the job. Secretary Galvin's office confirmed citywide ballot shortage and voting machine failures during the 2024 election. That year, the officials chose to only send enough ballots for 80% of each precinct registered voters who had not yet voted. The ballot numbers that ultimately arrived was even lower due to what Secretary Galvin's office described as a calculation error. The City of Boston's Police Department had to rush over additional ballots before the polls closed. The election department also did not answer more than 1,000 calls from poll workers and residents trying to report issues. The receivership is set to continue through the end of the year, at which point the office will meet with city officials to reassess the base of the factors, including administration of the upcoming election. Secretary Galvin and the city officials also made several changes before the city's election last fall, when Mayor Wu and every seat on the city council were on the ballot. The changes included creating specific phone lines for poll workers to report problems and sending tablets to each precinct for workers to search for residents' voter registration information. The city has also hired its national consulting firm to modernize the election department's communication and strengthening the training for poll workers and volunteers, and reconsider how the city calculates the number of ballots to send to each polling station.
Okay, thank you. We're going to move to the sports section now. And on the front page here is an article, "He's Been in Tracy's Shoes," and it's written by Peter Abraham. Nobody can better relate to what Chad Tracy has experienced this season as interim manager of the Red Sox than Diamondbacks manager Torey Lovullo. Lovullo was bench coach of the Red Sox in 2015 when manager John Farrell learned he had stage 1 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Farrell revealed the shocking news to the team on August 14th, then stepped aside for the remainder of the season to receive treatment. Lovullo led the Sox to a 28-20 record, drawing praise for how he handled the team during a difficult time. To this day, Mookie Betts, Xander Bogaerts, and Eduardo Rodriguez are among the players who hold Lovullo in high regard for the way he gracefully handled a difficult situation. "One of the most important people in my career," said Rodriguez, who signed with the Diamondbacks before the 2024 season in part because he wanted to play for Lovullo again. Lovullo doesn't know Tracy, but from afar, he has been impressed with the job he has done since replacing Alex Cora in April. "Just look at the standings. He's been great," Lovullo said before his team beat the Sox 7-6 in 10 innings Wednesday. What caught Lovullo's eye when he prepared for the series was how the Red Sox put pressure on opposing defenses. "They're built that way. They know their roles. They're very dynamic," he said. "They have a lot of really good athletes. Rafaela is a perfect example. He can bang the ball off a green monster as well as anybody. And then next game, he's going to put a bunt down and play the small ball game. They're well-trained, and they're prepared. I think that's coaching and the responsibility of the players to get it done. The execution is very, very crisp. They put a lot of pressure on us, and we know what they're able to do." Lovullo was 50 when he managed the Red Sox for those 48 games. Farrell returned for the 2016 season, and Lavulo was hired by the Diamondbacks before the 2017 season. Among active managers, only Tampa Bay's Kevin Cash and Dave Roberts of the Dodgers have been with the same team longer. Farrell was fired after the 17 season and replaced by Cora. I've often wondered how Red Sox history would have changed had Farrell moved into the front office after his recovery and Lavulo stayed on as manager. It can be difficult to manage in a market like Boston, but Lavulo handled all the responsibility smoothly and struck a balance in how he managed veterans and prospects. He seemed like a perfect fit for the job. Tracy, who turned 41 in July, will almost surely manage the Sox beyond the season. The team had a remarkable turnaround on his watch and is positioned to make the postseason as a wild card. He's a known commodity at this point and has shown he can work well with Chief Baseball Officer Craig Breslow. Tracy has said he wants to stay on, but beyond that has focused on the day-to-day aspects of running the team. Given how well the Sox have played since late June, perhaps it's best to wait until the end of the season before giving Tracy the job permanently. The way the Sox are playing, leave well enough alone. At this point, Tracy will probably be voted American League Manager of the Year. As Lavulo did in 2015, Tracy has made it about the team and not himself. He deflects praise, credits the players, and adeptly tamps down the occasional fires that spring up. From the other side of the field, Lavulo sees the similarities. He once stood in that same dugout at Fenway Park. "Tracy is doing a great job," he said. "Watching them in person, you can see that." Over to you, Mary.
Oh, thank you. Massachusetts doles out $27 million in tax credits to climate tech firms. Program aims to retain, expand clean tech startup in state. By John Chesto of the Globe staff. Reframe System Chief Executive Vikas Enti as another reason to reassure investors that picking Billerica for the new factory and headquarters instead of a cheaper site in New Hampshire was the right call, and an $800,000 tax credit courtesy of the state of Massachusetts. Reframe is among the 18 winners announced Wednesday by the quasi-public Massachusetts Clean Energy Center in the first round of its new Climate Tech Tax Incentive Program, created with the state bond funds authorized by the 2024 economic development legislation. The new program is aimed at making Massachusetts more competitive with other states that already offer such enticements. In Reframe case, it also helps offset some of the real estate costs associated with more expensive factory leases in Billerica, where the prefabricated housing manufacturer plans to open up a 115,000 square foot facility this fall versus not one far away in New Hampshire. "It's a big signal," Enti said. "I'm glad that the state is doing this. Our investments have been pushing on the question of why we are opening a factory in Massachusetts and not in New Hampshire." Reframe exemplifies the kind of concept that MassCEC wants to see spur more jobs and private sector investments while curbing carbon emissions. Let me turn the page here. Okay. Carbon emissions. And in Reframe's case, it uses robots to assemble many parts of its home factory and then trucks those parts to be reassembled or assembled on site into a house. Enti said his firm can put up a house to the point it passes a building inspection within 30 days of the foundation's installation. The company already employs 80 people in the state, including its existing smaller plant in Andover, and hopes to get 100 by the end of the year after Bill Ricker's factory opens. The talent pool is stronger in Massachusetts, and therefore more business opportunities are available, Enti said, but real estate and labor are still more expensive here in Massachusetts than in New Hampshire. The awards range in size from $100,000 for small startups to $7.5 million for two established clean tech companies, Commonwealth Fusion Systems and Electric Hydrogen, both in Devens. Kristen Cullen, Vice President of Global Policy and Public Affairs at the Commonwealth Fusion, said that the new incentive program will help
give momentum to the state's climate tech economy, in part of encouraging by companies to grow and hire more people here. Her company plans to use the credits to help pay for the prototype fusion energy machine it is building in its headquarters. It's a good signal for Massachusetts on where the state's priorities are and that they're prioritizing this clean tech system. Form Energy, which makes utility-scale batteries that hold power for several days, received the third largest tax credit award of $5.7 million. Its new headquarters are in Somerville and hosted Governor Maura Healey at a press conference announcing the filling of the Mass Leads bill in 2024. Through its largest workforce site today is a factory in Weirton, West Virginia. Former President Ted Wiley said in a statement that he is grateful for the Healey administration's work in fostering a world-class climate technology ecosystem. Wiley pledged that the company is not done expanding in Somerville, where it employs around 250 people, and the tax credit award reinforces the benefits of investing in and growing a climate-focused business in the state. Although the tax credits were envisioned before President Trump was elected, Downing says that they now have a broader benefit of offsetting some of the losses in federal support that the climate tech sector has been seen in the past year or so. The program differs from Mass Life Science Center program, providing incentives for job growth or capital investment or lease costs of at least $5 million within the previous 2 years. The Life Sentence Center tax incentives is just for promising of adding new jobs. Most of the biggest awards in Mass CEC inaugural rounds are for capital expenditures.
Okay, so should we go back to the front page now? The surprise and fury of Hurricane Bob. This is on the front page with some pictures from 25 years ago. New England's last landfalling hurricane had all the right makings of a potent storm to defy a strong El Nino in 1991. It's written by Ken Mahan. 35 years ago, New England learned a lesson that meteorologists still talk about today. It only takes one storm. Nearly all of the hurricane models had been forecasting calm seas. A rather quiet year. But as the Atlantic season was nearing its halfway point in 1991, a surprise storm surfaced off the Bahamas. Days later, Hurricane Bob was on a collision course with New England and on August 19th came ashore not once, but twice, in Rhode Island as a Category 2 storm, carving a path through southeastern Massachusetts with destructive winds topping 100 miles per hour and pounding a 15-foot storm surges. It later made landfall a third time in Maine. When all was said and done, Bob had killed 18 people from South Carolina to Nova Scotia, including 12 here in New England. The storm caused more than $1 billion in damage. Dozens of homes were destroyed, countless trees crashed through roofs, torrential rains washed out and ripped up roads, boats were stripped from their moorings and tossed onto lawns, and hundreds of thousands were left without power for days. It was a truly remarkable storm because, on paper, 1991 wasn't supposed to be a memorable hurricane season. As it's forecast this year, a strong El Nino was in full swing, making the idea of Bob an unlikely New England blockbuster. Typically, the strong vertical wind shear from an El Nino tears apart and suppresses any tropical storm development across the Atlantic. But Bob survived, becoming the only landfalling hurricane out of four hurricanes that emerged that 1991 season. New England hasn't seen one since. To put it in perspective, an average Atlantic season alone sees seven hurricanes. What I find especially interesting this year as we head toward peak hurricane season amid a potentially historic El Nino is how Bob and a small number of other storms defied the odds. We know El Nino sharply diminishes Atlantic hurricane activity, especially a very strong one. But suppressed does not mean impossible. The last five seasons in which El Nino reached strong to super status, tropical Pacific waters heat up at least 2 degrees Celsius or 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit above normal, still managed to churn out hurricanes. Those five seasons, 1972, 1982, 1991, 1997, and 2015, combined spawned 21 tropical storms and 16 hurricanes, of which three became landfalling hurricanes. Three that defied the odds of not just a regular El Nino, but an extremely robust one. The strongest among them? Bob. El Nino can stack the odds against Atlantic hurricanes, but if one storm finds the right combination of hot ocean waters, steering currents, and atmospheric conditions, then seasonal statistics don't mean much. The warmest water and best regions for hurricanes to form and strengthen during an El Nino are in the Gulf and along the East Coast, where wind shear is low and the waters are relatively the warmest. You can also get kickstarters for storms as frontal boundaries break down once they reach the ocean and new systems materialize over a new fuel source. Most of the storms that made landfall during strong to super El Nino seasons occurred across the Gulf Coast, with Agnes in 1972 regenerating after exiting North Carolina and slamming into New York as a tropical storm. Bob didn't exactly come out of nowhere. It began from an area of thunderstorms associated with an old cold front between Bermuda and the Bahamas around August 14th, before quickly strengthening into a tropical depression, then a tropical storm east of Daytona Beach on August 16th. Tony Petrarca, chief meteorologist at WPRI-TV in Providence, remembers the early warning signs, but also recalls how quickly everything came together. The rule of thumb is any modest circulation in August and September near the Bahamas is something that should be monitored here in New England, Petrarca said. And the atmosphere was giving forecasters another clue. The steering winds in the upper part of the atmosphere before the storm pointed towards a possible New England threat, he said. Bob then encountered the warm waters of the Gulf Stream and intensified rapidly. By August 18th, it had become a major Category 3 hurricane with winds of around 115 miles per hour off the Carolina coast. The satellite pictures were impressive, Petrarca remembers, with a well-defined eye staring back just offshore. And I think that's all we have. Time for today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm going to go home and practice saying I can't say it still.
This is Mary saying thank you for listening to us.
And this is Kelly.
And Kelly.
Thank you. Have a great day.